Give the people what they want.
Give the people what they want.
Give the people what they want. Your weekly movement news roundup.
This is show number 149 of Give the People What They Want, brought to you by People's Dispatch. And boy, it's great to have Prashant back. Prashant and Zoe from People's Dispatch, your favorite news site on the internet. I'm Vijay from Globetrotter. Another tough week in Gaza. Tough week. Lots more bombing. It has become now almost a cliche to say that this is a bombardment that the people of Gaza have never seen before. Nothing like this. Not in 2014, not in 2008, 2009. Most recently, really ghastly news from the Palestinian Health Ministry saying that the Rantisi medical compound, in which there's the Al-Rantisi Hospital, there's the Al-Nasser Children's Hospital, and the psychiatric hospital, have been surrounded by Israeli tanks, and the Israelis are telling people to leave there. Very much an active war crime, because the Geneva Convention's Article 19 specifically says that you cannot target medical institutions. Of course, cannot target medical institutions. Overnight, there were a bunch of airstrikes. Al-Shifa Hospital, the biggest hospital in Gaza, was hit. The maternity ward, I saw images from there. It was just terrible to watch, very difficult to look at. It's striking, so striking that Human Rights Watch's Israel and Palestine director Omar Shakir said on it's called X now, formerly Twitter, Israel hasn't put forward evidence that justifies stripping Al-Shifa of its protections. Its warning is ineffective, as there's no safe place to go in Gaza and hospitals cannot be free fire zones. But that's exactly what has been happening. Mr. Benjamin Netanyahu, meanwhile, has gone on television to say that, you know what, this is taking longer than I expected. In the United States, trying to make some noises about the possibility of slowing things down, doesn't look like they're going to be able to get much in the way from the Israelis. They're pretty hard about what should happen. Interestingly, the U.S. government has started to talk a little bit about what's the post-war scenario for Gaza. Here's an interesting thing. A lot of talk about democracy, you know, since the 1990s, it became the term of the epoch, that you're going to have democratization and so on. Here you have a situation where Hamas won an election, which people were hard-pressed to say it was any more of a stolen election than any election at the time. But in 2005, they win an election, come to power. Now, the United States is saying that let the Israelis go and wipe out Hamas from Gaza. And then the Palestinian Authority should take over. You know, there's no discussion about an election or anything. It's just the imposition of the Palestinian Authority. That's the vision that the United States is putting forward. The Israelis, meanwhile, have a vision called the bulldozer vision. They have the bulldozers basically running through northern Gaza. Looks very clear that this is a situation of ethnic cleansing. They are wiping out neighborhoods. Not only by bomb, but by bulldozer. It looks like they're not going to permit people to rebuild their homes, at least in the northern part of Gaza, north of Saladin Street. Although I must say that in recent days, again, there's been bombardment south of Saladin Street. It's not like the Israelis are respecting their own warnings to the Palestinians of Gaza, saying, go south of Saladin Street and you'll be safe. We're going to just bomb in the north. Now they seem to be bombing in the south, which is why Human Rights Watch says, well, there's no place for the people of Gaza to go where they are not getting bombed. The Egyptians opened the border at the Rafah crossing briefly for dual passport holders, but that has seemed to have closed down again. You're not seeing aid come in sufficient numbers. You're not seeing people allowed to leave. I think, therefore, it's very clear that language of ethnic cleansing, language of genocide is still on the table. People are being starved to death. They are being made to live without water. And because they can't get dead bodies under buildings and so on. There's putrefaction. There will be disease. And since people are living in close quarters, there is putrefaction. You're going to have disease spread like wildfire without water. Very hard for medical personnel to basically, prevent the spread of disease. Very hard without water, without the ability to clean. Meanwhile, in all this, the group of seven ministers meet in close quarters, Prashant, and they talk about that ridiculous term, a humanitarian pause. Tell us about this whole direction of the humanitarian pause.
Right, Vijay, a lot of it actually builds on what you were talking about, which is really that, you know, the whole idea of how Israel has sort of defined its assault, its genocidal assault as some kind of a strategic, war plan or something, whereas it's very clearly just ethnic cleansing. It is genocide that is taking place. And the idea of the humanitarian pause basically means is to really support that perspective. Now, what is this so-called humanitarian pause? The idea of the humanitarian pause works on this notion that for 3 to 4 hours a day, Israel will not conduct offensive operations, whether it be bombings or whatever. And they will give warnings in advance so that people can leave the northern part of Gaza for the southern part. And I think, like one commentator pointed out, what this means is basically 20 hours of genocide and 4 hours of ethnic cleansing. So, what this is basically setting out to do is basically create a scenario for people to leave Gaza as though that is less of a war crime in any sense. And we need to sort of go a bit into the past few weeks, because we know that when the United Nations discussed this across the world, governments of the global south, especially governments of Africa, governments of Latin America, were pushing for a ceasefire. We have seen people's movements across the world talk about the urgent need for a ceasefire. And at that point of time, the United States and its allies kept, insisting on what was called the humanitarian pause. And this is exactly what has happened in the G7 meeting, foreign ministers meeting that was held in Japan this week as well, all of them backing the idea of a humanitarian, so-called notion of a humanitarian pause. And, we have to be very clear about the fact that this is a very cynical and, almost criminal use of the word humanitarian to basically talk about what is just a brief halt in operations, which might actually benefit Israel's offensive operations more, because they end up collecting more data, more intelligence, by which they will continue these kind of attacks. So the fact that this humanitarian pause is some big deal, I think, has to be continuously contested. It is shocking to see how the United States authorities, for instance, keep flaunting the idea of this humanitarian pause as some big achievement. We talked about this before, how time and again, U.S. officials have, just utterly dismissed, including Biden, I believe yesterday, completely dismissed the idea of a ceasefire, saying that, Israel has a right to defend itself, etc., etc. So this humanitarian pause being the only viable or, seemingly being the best humanitarian option, so to speak, at this point, there is no greater proof of Israel's criminality of the kind of operations it is conducting than this situation right now. The fact that the most powerful economic countries in the world are united in sanctioning this kind of violence, in endorsing this kind of violence, really, I think, says a lot. And like you said, we have hospitals being attacked, we have Red Cross convoys being attacked, we have the maximum number of UN workers being killed in the UN's history of relief operations. This is just the UN, of course. We're talking about, if you look at the Red Crescent, if you look at other relief organizations, it's much, much more. And despite all this, there is, also a complete failure in terms of global governance, because there was another attempt, I believe, by China and the UAE to sort of bring in this notion, to bring this discussion up, again, did not go anywhere. So I think in all this context, it's very interesting to see what is going to happen in the next few days, because we have the leaders of Arab countries meeting, over the coming days. And Iran's president also, I believe, expected to address this session. And this is really a very interesting moment, because this is a challenge before many Arab governments who in the past have adopted normalization as a paradigm with Israel, have gone completely with it. And now, as their people are, united, are steadfast against Israeli occupation, what position do they take? What kind of an alternative can they present? Will they take a stand is, I think, really a question top of the minds of many people at this point. So I think in the coming week, we're going to see many of these challenges ahead as well.
That's exactly correct. You know, Prashant, in the first several weeks of the war, the Israeli government said that they challenged the numbers of dead coming from the Gaza Ministry of Health. United States backed them up, said, look, we don't think the numbers are accurate now. The Gaza Ministry of Health or the Palestinian Ministry of Health, it says it's over 10,000. I was very interested to hear Barbara Leaf, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State. You know, she went before a congressional committee on the 8th of November. At that meeting, she said that the number of dead in Gaza could be even higher, she said. And then she said, we'll know only after the guns fall silent. So even within the Biden administration, there is an acknowledgement that things are perhaps worse than even they admitted earlier. Higher death toll, Zoe. Is that why there's so many people around the world saying, shut it down for Palestine, shut the whole thing down?
Yeah, well, yesterday people did shut it down. And I think that's exactly right, that the level of atrocities and horrors that people are seeing every single day on their phones, on the TV, well, not less so on the TV, but mostly on their phones and on digital media websites, has really driven people to this place of being willing to take constant action. Yesterday, there was a global call for action to shut it down for Palestine. We saw people blocking weapons companies in several countries. We saw people occupying corporate headquarters of companies that invest in countries that are complicit in the genocide, people picketing outside of politicians' offices. I mean, a whole diversity of actions, also thousands of high school students walking out of school. This is definitely the highest level of mobilization, at least in the United States, that I think has ever been seen, not only for Palestine, but really for any issue in recent history. I mean, the fact that people from all walks of life, from all sectors, are taking action around this is really something. And I think that, again, what we've talked about, this deafening silence of U.S. politicians in the face of this level of mobilizations, is making people take action even more, because they're seeing this is not a problem of people being uninformed or not doing everything in their power to take action. This is a clear example of there being clear economic and geopolitical interest in continuing to back this genocidal state, this genocide project, and that it doesn't matter. It would appear that to, you know, even Democratic senators who appear to be to the left, like Bernie Sanders, he said there won't be a ceasefire. And I think people are so enraged by this callousness of the U.S. political establishment and of their complete disregard for human life in Gaza, but also for their own constituents. And that has driven people, again, to the streets day after day, week after week. And this power is only building. And as organizers of the international shutdown have said, that if politicians won't listen to constant calls, to constant mobilizations, then they're going to make the business of genocide unsustainable. And so that's why we're seeing so many more actions in all cities and all sectors. Again, this is a really watershed moment for people's movements, for the movement in support of Free Palestine. We're seeing people's consciousness being shifted. Maybe 5 years ago, the idea that millions of people would be protesting and saying the occupation of Palestine must end, maybe that didn't seem possible. And now it's not only happening across the world, but it's happening in the country that has the strongest base of support militarily and economically. And at one point, ideologically and politically, from a large base, which is the United States. And so this is shifting consciousness. People are on the streets. I know that there's another day of action called for the 17th. People are going to continue protesting. And I think what's interesting about this moment is that people aren't waiting. They're taking action in all ways that they can. People are using social media like never before, posting constantly about what's happening. And so this is a real moment. Palestine is kind of tearing off this blindfold for a lot of people, not only about the reality of what Israel's doing, but also about politicians and how they act in these kind of situations, that it's not actually about what your constituents think and what is the right thing to do, but actually their actions really respond to a set of interests that are not in favor of their own people and not in favor of the people of Palestine, nor really of the people in Israel, because we've seen that people in Israel are protesting as well and saying, release the Palestinian prisoners because they want their hostages back. So it's a moment where the voice of the masses is starting to overpower the voice of the minority politicians.
Palestine has torn the blindfold from people's eyes, says Zoe, on Give the People What They Want, which is brought to you by People's Dispatch. That's Zoe and Prashant. I'm Vijay from Globetrotter. There was another UN General Assembly vote, not much paid attention to, against unilateral coercive sanctions. The vote was 128 against unilateral coercive sanctions, 54 for them. Of course, the 54 were all the countries you'd expect, the Europeans, United States, Canadians, Australians, New Zealand, and so on. Prashant, very interesting. Two countries voted against unilateral coercive sanctions. One of them was the Democratic Republic of the Congo. I would expect that actually. The other was Rwanda. Interesting that Rwanda also voted against the United States and Israel and so on for that. Of course, Rwanda's proxy force M23 is in the Congo. Very good article, long article at People's Dispatch on the displacements in the Congo. I think 7 million, Prashant. What's the story in the Democratic Republic of the Congo?
Absolutely right. Also, we have a recent episode of our show, Daily Debrief, where Kambale Musawuli has explained some of these dimensions in a very powerful way as well. And like you said, 7 million people displaced in the DRC due to this fighting. And I think it's been almost 2 years since this fighting has extensively started. There have been some bits of, some ceasefires in between which are not really worked out. But like you said, the most important thing is the fact that the M23 group, and often this conflict is, purely analyzed in terms of ethnic tensions and stuff like that. But I think alongside that, and perhaps as important, if not more, is the fact that there is widespread understanding of the fact that acceptance of the fact that this M23 militia is armed and backed by Rwanda. So clearly the question of why Rwanda continues to back this M23 militia and why Rwanda continues to enjoy this amount of impunity while doing so is very central as far as the people of the Democratic Republic of the Congo are concerned. And this is not a question that started with just the M23 in 2021, because the M23 itself is a group with a long history of various names, and all these points of time, it has been backed by Rwanda. There is a long history stretching back to the 90s when Rwanda and Uganda were responsible for the deaths of millions of people in the DRC, for which at least Rwanda has not paid any price. In fact, Rwanda has acted as an enforcer of the United States, of the United Kingdom in Africa, and that is actually, in fact, a source of a lot of Rwanda's economy, and for that matter, its credibility globally, so-called credibility globally as well. So when it comes to this specific conflict, we know that this has been going on for some time. There are East African community forces in Congo. Supposedly, they were originally deployed to sort of, hold or fight the M23, then did not, which is not surprising considering the fact that this community also consists of Rwanda itself. So Rwanda is a member of the organization which is deploying soldiers against a militia which Rwanda was backing. That's the, there is an irony, is 9,000 deaths at this point. And which is why this force is incredibly unpopular. Its mandate is unlikely to be extended. Similarly unpopular is the UN peacekeeping forces as well, which have been completely discredited, although it's a very expensive UN operation, maybe the longest and the largest, and that has also been discredited. So what we're seeing basically is that a large section, large parts, there are even towns in the DRC which are completely out of the control of the government. And at this point of time, people are just leaving areas of conflict in droves. There's really no solution. And ultimately, I think the situation in the DRC is a direct challenge, is a direct question to the African Union, to various organizations in Africa, and to the international community itself, that why such a situation is allowed to continue where Rwanda continues to back the M23 in this conflict and allow it to perpetuate. So all the statements, all these peacekeeping forces, all the sort of comments that are made are kind of irrelevant when it comes down to this. DRC also having an election next month. We'll be closely following that. Massive concerns being raised about whether the election will be fair. The current president, Felix Tshisekedi, won in 2018 in what was considered widely to be a process that was rigged, a process that, you know, a process of compromise between him and the former establishment of Joseph Kabila. Whether Tshisekedi will continue to perpetuate those irregularities remains to be seen as well. So a very important few weeks for the DRC and a few couple of coming months as well.
Well, elections in the DRC, this is going to be the jump to the next story, Prashant. I'm sorry to say take advantage of that because Zoe is back on the election beat in South America. In Argentina, it's the top card of the fight. Massa versus Milei, the center versus the hard right. Extraordinary situation. 1 week to go. Maybe the city of Buenos Aires, 37% of the votes of the whole country is going to save the day. Who knows? Will Milei take Argentina out of BRICS? Zoe, what's going on there?
Well, Milei would definitely like to take Argentina out of BRICS and break economic ties with Brazil. However, he does say that as he wants to limit the state to the smallest entity possible, any individual or any company has the freedom to do business with whoever they want. Just a little taste of his bizarre thinking. However, as bizarre and as maybe difficult to follow as Milei is and his proposals, the latest poll regarding these elections, which are going to take place in just over a week, has Sergio Massa polling at 46.7% and Milei at 45.3%. And so that means that this is an extremely close race. This is, again, the second round of the elections. In the primary elections, Milei had been polling. Milei actually achieved the largest vote share with just over 30%. Massa in the first round of the elections was able to actually overcome this. However, after this first round of the elections, the center right slash traditional right, it's hard to kind of decipher between these right wing positions. And now, apparently now, just not wanting to dissolve the central bank can make you a centrist. But I think really what it is this right-wing bloc that's represented by figures such as Mauricio Macri, Patricia Bullrich, Gerardo Morales, who's the governor of Jujuy. This bloc has been essentially in flux since the first round of the elections because they're left with this choice, which is, okay, Massa, Sergio Massa, he is in theory, Peronista, he is allied with people like Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner. And as we know in Argentina, the process of lawfare has been accompanied by a media campaign to essentially demonize anything that's related to Cristina Kirchner, this anti-Kirchnerismo, similar to what we saw in Brazil with the anti-Lula, anti-PT. So you have Massa, who's directly associated to that. He's the current economy minister. He has historically been in this Kirchnerista, Peronista bloc, which again is extremely heterogeneous, does not mean he's left-wing. He's really a centrist. However, he still is related to them. And then on the other hand, you have this person, Javier Milei, who said he's going to, again, dissolve the central bank, dollarize the economy. And so you have people like Gerardo Morales, who was a presidential candidate for this Together for Change bloc, but did not proceed to the elections. He's saying he is against Milei because if Milei wins, then he's not going to have a budget to pay his municipal workers with. He's the governor of a province. And so you see many, many divisions within this right bloc of how to proceed because they hate Peronista so much, but also if Milei wins, they literally cannot go about business as usual and it's going to destroy the economy. I think that's why we saw this week a letter was released and signed by over 100 economists saying that the economic plan of Milei is dangerous and destructive for Argentina, a country that's already reeling from an economic crisis. Again, there's over 40% of the Argentine population is living below the poverty line, record levels of hunger, record levels of unemployment. This has been slightly ameliorated in the past 2 months due to emergency measures taken by Sergio Massa. But the fact remains that Argentina is in an economic crisis. Inflation last in 2022 was 100%. The devaluation of their currency is one of the highest levels of devaluation in the world, several hundred percent from the past couple of years ago. And if Milei takes office and he implements this plan, it will cause further destruction for the people. And so, again, a lot of these right-wing centrist parties are saying that we're taking a position of neutrality. But within this bloc, we've seen different politicians actually say either they're not going to support Milei, they don't support his policies, and that this would be destructive. So it honestly is a very tenuous situation in terms that there's no... It doesn't seem like one candidate is kind of leaning ahead before the other. One would think that Massa being having the more sensible and not destructive policy would be pulling way ahead. But we know that this the legacy of anti-kirchnerismo and also the legacy of Alberto Fernández's government means that for a lot of people, it's not that easy of a decision.
And also, it's very hard to believe that the far right is just, you know, not legitimate because some of the things people say are crazy. In the United States, the Biden collapse of his vote share most likely going to lead to an open lane for Trump. Here we go again. You know, Trump at one end of the Americas, and could it be Milei at the other? Terrifying thought. The war in Gaza has, of course, had a lot of knock-on effects. You know, on the second day of the war, President of Iran spoke with the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. They opened a channel of discussion, seemingly put in abeyance a project that the United States has put a lot of stake on. This is the so-called India, Middle East, Europe corridor, which was to started in Gujarat, gone to Dubai by sea, then from Dubai overland across Saudi Arabia, up the Hijaz Railroad, really, the old Hijaz Railroad, to the port of Haifa, and then from the port of Haifa to Piraeus in Greece. There was always going to be problems with this project because the Turks, for instance, were not happy with the idea of ships going between Haifa and Piraeus using what they considered to be Turkish waters. This is known as the Aegean dispute. There was always a problem, in a sense, with the IMEC project. Also, the United States said that this is really about isolating China and going, you know, around the Belt and Road Initiative run by China. Actually, that was also not interesting because the port of Piraeus is managed by a Chinese company and the port at Dubai is in partnership with two Chinese shipping companies. So, in fact, the IMEC was going to utilize the Belt and Road, not go around it. Now, with this war, it looks very unlikely that Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates are going to go along with anything that uses Israeli ports. By the way, the port of Haifa is owned by Gautam Adani's Adani Port, which is a company, an Indian company. Mr. Adani himself, very close to the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. So it's not exactly an Israeli port. It's more an Adani port, but it has to go. It is on Israeli territory. Very unlikely that the at least the Saudis and the UAE would go along with this. It looks scuttled. Although I must say, in the last couple of days, the Saudis have continued to talk with the United States about IMEC as a possibility. Now, the other issue with this, of course, is it relies on private sector funding. If a war like this continues, it's very unlikely that the private sector is going to come in here with hundreds of billions of dollars to produce infrastructure, given the uncertainties in Gaza. And you know, everybody has been talking about the fact that off the coast of Gaza, there are natural gas fields. By the way, you don't actually need to have the Israelis eject the Palestinians from Gaza for Israel to be the solitary beneficiary of those natural gas fields, largely because Israel controls all the waters off the beaches of Gaza and would never be doing any kind of revenue sharing. There's never the possibility of a two-state solution where somebody might go to court and say that's my natural gas. Nonetheless, lots of business interests have been now junked in the pile as a consequence of this war in Gaza, including the process of normalization between Saudi Arabia and Israel, pretty much in the junk pile for now. Look at all the information you get in half an hour with Give the People What They Want, Prashant and Zoe from People's Dispatch. I'm Vijay from Globetrotter. This has been show 149. That means next week it's the 150th show. And we have a surprise planned for you. See you then.